Hey, Connor, are you there?
I am, Jake. How are you doing?
I'm doing good, man. So what's up?
Well, you know, I've been thinking about what to talk about, and I wanted to connect a couple of dots here that I've kind of been thinking about the past week or two. And I don't know if you saw this come out. This was probably just over a week ago, where one of the editors of the New York Times, he was leaving the paper, been there for a while, and in his final column, among the things that he wrote, he basically disclosed his opinion, kind of laid it bare finally since he was on his way out voluntarily, that the New York Times is a progressive liberal paper. Of course, that's no shock to anyone with a brain, anyone with, you know, two eyes to see, but the paper, you know, as any journalistic institution might, tries to shroud itself in claims of objectivity, that they are fair and balanced in the words of Fox News. And
yeah.
So here you had a you know, fairly prominent editor coming out and saying publicly that it was his view that he was agreeing with the critics or people who observe of the New York Times that they are a liberal paper. And by that I mean, and I believe he meant, that kind of bleeds through what they report on, what they choose to report on, how they report, what they do report, what they happen to exclude, the people who they interview. And so that was his charge. And, of course, there was a retort, a rebuttal by the executive editor of the New York Times that that's totally false and there's no way that can be true. And she did at least concede that the customer base of the New York Times is kind of a cosmopolitan, urban, progressive outfit. And so maybe their social stuff, she said, kind of caters to that because of where they are in New York, of course. And I found it interesting to kind of sit back, and I haven't commented about this until now, just to kind of observe the, well, I think I actually did tweet about this when it came out, but to observe in the meantime the conservative reaction to this allegation made by this outgoing editor. And, of course, all this feigned shock that, oh, you know, finally someone admits it and opens up, and all the people who have been believing this for a while are vindicated that the New York Times is liberal and therefore we should disregard them. And I kind of had to wonder and pause when I would read those retorts from the conservative side and think, you know, who didn't believe that? Who didn't think that the New York Times was liberal and progressive in their views and how and what they chose to report? And really, for me, it's kind of at a more fundamental level than this kind of superficial banter between conservatism and liberalism. It's that the New York Times is like any other institution. It's comprised of humans, and humans inherently have bias. And so, of course, any institution is going to be biased. And so you can say, well, of course, the New York Times at least claimed objectivity, so that was the difference with many other groups that might wear their bias on their sleeve. But even so, why would anyone think that objectivity, I mean, even this is kind of a radical view when you think about how it applies to literally any human institution. So take the judicial branch, for example. Any court system, it's often claimed that this black robe wearing lawyer is somehow, you know, able to define what is just, be able to arrive at all the facts in an unbiased manner. No, he's a human. And while you can try, while that can be an ideal that some, I think, who are more fair-minded and just will try and pursue, they have their own biases. They have their own, you know, culture and paradigm. And it's really interesting, and I think you'll agree with this, agree with me on this, is that it's not that the New York Times has a progressive view or that the Deseret News, for example, has a conservative view. It's that too many of these institutions have a status view. And it's not so much the left or the right or the progressive and liberal or the conservative. It's that all of these human institutions are inherently leaning towards statism. And whatever the left or right flavor is, from my vantage point, I see that as largely irrelevant. What I kind of object to is that there's any supposed claim of not having any bias in these institutions at all. So New York Times, of course they're biased. Of course they have that kind of predisposition to selectively report on things that might favor their worldview. But the Deseret News, for example, here in Utah, does the same thing. So I would kind of hope that the lesson learned from this is that don't trust anyone, really, if that's kind of a good conclusion to make, is that at least try and read into things the biases that the people probably have, even if they don't wear them on their sleeve. And I think the problem that many have is they're kind of trusting of authority. They kind of look to these institutions that they agree with, and then they kind of go further down the rabbit hole in that bias because they don't have their eyes open and they don't realize that this institution, this, you know, New York Times, for example, is selectively reporting on things that further their own ends. And I kind of hesitate to kind of lambast these accusations. I think a lot of this is subconscious, right? That these people kind of have a worldview, they have a paradigm, and so naturally the people who they want to talk to and report, the way that they report on things, the precedence that they happen to give different news stories, I think kind of inherently is guided by those subconscious thoughts that they have.
Well, I think you're spot on it, because guess what? I do the same thing. The problem is I'm on, you know, a few websites and on KTalk. I'm not MSNBC.
Right.
And so, yes, everybody's going to have their own biases. And that said, you're right. I mean, I just posted on my Facebook the other day a quote by George Orwell, 1984, Animal Farm, that guy, that the real battle is not between conservatives and, as he called them, revolutionaries, or maybe progressives or something. The real battle is not between conservatives and revolutionaries, but between authoritarians and libertarians.
Mm-hmm.
And that is across the board, because you'll find a Dennis Kucinich in the Democratic Party. Now, they marginalized him. You'll find a Ron Paul within the GOP. They marginalized him. Same with Gary Johnson, marginalized him. And so what we have to do is we have to start expressing our preference, because I think, I don't make claims to any special kind of insight or psychic powers or anything, but when I talk to most people are socially tolerant and fiscally responsible. Most people are libertarian, but these institutions, the media, like you're mentioning the New York Times, they take that and then create these divisions and then offer up the state as the only solution.
Yeah, and really it's funny because conservatives try and get good at reading into the liberal bias. People, you know, they accuse the media of having liberal bias, but then of course you have the flip side and you say, you know, liberals accuse the media of having conservative bias. So they try and kind of pinpoint where in the media they're favoring one ideology or another, but they are so trapped in this false left-right spectrum that they don't realize that if they step outside that, they see that they're just kind of, you know, two sides of the same coin. And they're getting good at trying to observe some potential liberal bias in the media, but they have complete blinders on when it comes to observing the statist bias in the media. That the alternative that they offer up, as you mentioned, is always the state. But where is the alternative? That's
well, and here's
that
the thing. If we were able to really, because of a critical mass of liberty-minded folks, to pull back the power of the state, then those people who try to use the state to push their progressive agenda or their neoconservative agenda, they wouldn't be able to do it. And it's okay. Well, you can be a neocon. Just leave that crap off my body. And same with being a progressive.
Sure. And I think a lot of it, what it comes down to, is the emperor has no clothes, right? Like, everyone knows that the guy's naked, but they don't really know it. They haven't internalized it. They don't realize it. Maybe they don't want to out of fear of recrimination. It takes people to stand up and point it out for everyone to catch on to the fact.
Yeah, probably because they won't look at him in the eye. If they looked him in the eye, they'd say, holy moly, man. Yeah, all right, guys, come on back. We're in the middle of the Boyack Review right here, Mental Self-Defense Radio. Hey, talk to Boise, Utah. All right, guys, we are back, Mental Self-Defense Radio. I am Jake Shannon. We are joined, as we are every Tuesday, at 2:30 by Connor Boyack. Connor, so we're talking a little bit about media bias and whatnot and how people can kind of pull their head out of the sand. I just find it just too obvious that, like, a couple things, especially since the GOP, they had their horse and pony show a couple days back. And, you know, one, they had the audacity to put the national debt clock up. Like, they weren't a massive contributor to the national debt, both right. Reagan and Bush, George W. But, you know, not one mention, actually. Not only did they totally marginalize and want people to forget about Ron Paul, the GOP seems everybody want to forget about George W. Bush, too. I found that interesting, you know?
Yeah, no mention of it at all, no throwback at all to kind of the great legacy that he's, you know, they're trying to get back to or anything. So I think that definitely was true. And really, I mean, I think that's where we're having success, where the Internet is really helping out, is exposing that bias, exposing the kind of, you know, the dog and pony show for what it is, right? Helping people understand that it's all a game, it's all a ruse at our expense, that nothing changes even when the national parties change, when the, you know, Republican versus the Democrat gets office. The trend is the same. And I think that, you know, a lot of that is due to the internet. I think you had a lot of people who were Obama supporters, for example, who were really anti-Bush, anti-war, and now they largely, those who have their eyes open at least, have seen that Obama's really just a third term of George W. Bush. He's just really escalated so much of what Bush did. So I think there's a lot of disenchantment, disillusion with people who were kind of recognizing that Bush was as bad as he was. So now, where do they stand? I think that's why we see the rise of the independents, the libertarians. I think we can really capitalize on this movement. But the problem, I think, stems, going back to the bias thing we're talking about, from simply having your eyes open and recognizing that these information gatekeepers have their biases and have selectively controlled the media. In fact, when I was working on the article for my book that comes out in a couple months, Latter-day Responsibility, I had a chapter in there about guns, the importance of protecting yourself, the right to bear arms. And in there, I kind of dived into some of the material about how the news media covers the use of guns. And John Lott wrote this excellent book where he really kind of, you know, compiled all these statistics on...
Yeah, more guns, less crime.
Yeah, how guns were being used and then how they were being reported. And so he found a significant counterbalance between the guns that were used for crime versus guns that were successfully used for defense, and how the media, almost to a T, simply did not even report that. And so by omitting things, they are guiding the news and shaping people's perception of, in this case, guns. And so I think that's why social media, internet, these things, you have completely independent people producing their own news, you know, finding their own news, being able to quickly fact-check on their own rather than simply sitting on their couch and watching a news program.
Yeah, I mean, guys like, you know, we got great guys out there spanning from Luke Radowski doing crazy killer investigative journalism to Tom Woods doing economic analysis. And if it weren't for the internet, we wouldn't be able to actually listen to these totally out of the norm of views.
Well, and I think to like an issue like the Federal Reserve, for example, that the tide has overwhelmingly turned against the Federal Reserve in the past several years.
Yes.
And so most people accredit that to, you know, Ron Paul's presidential candidacies,
yep,
raising the issue, the audit of the Fed legislation, and rightly so. He's been the significant, the most significant factor in elevating the discussion about the dangers and the threat of the Fed to prosperity and our economy as a whole. But then you go even a step deeper and say, well, why did Ron Paul have success? And I think it, again, ties back to the internet. The Federal Reserve would not be an issue anywhere to the degree it is if people were not able to, as you mentioned, you know, consume the material that some of these independent thinkers are producing, reading all these online articles for free, being able to read the reports that the Fed puts out, being able to chat with one another and kind of galvanize opposition. I really think things like tools like the internet have been immensely, if not necessary, at least supremely important in producing some of the results that we're seeing. And I think it's because Americans are now able to much more easily circumvent these gatekeepers and their biases. The problem that we see, just, you know, tying what I talked about at the beginning to this issue, okay, well, the New York Times has bias, and that's fine, that's great. But you look at, like, the Federal Reserve, you know, how are they not biased? These are economists, these are humans, and they sit up there and try and opine on the government before Congress or in their open market committee meetings and say, well, you know, we need to, unemployment isn't where we want it to be, and kind of issue these. In fact, who was that? I think it was Alan Greenspan in an interview. He was played a clip that he had testified before Congress, and I think it was Diane Sawyer. She played like a 30-second clip of something he had said before committee, and they both laughed. And she's like, you know, you're not making any sense here. He's like, I know, isn't that great? He's like,
it's just a bunch of like obscure jargon.
Gobbledygook, right?
And, you know, and you raise a good point because there's a really great book. It's something like, I read it so long ago, but it's basically about fraud at the Fed. And it was written by a guy who is a part of the Fed. And he has this, his last name's Auerbach, Deception and Abuse at the Fed. And in it, Robert Auerbach, who used to be with the House Banking Committee, basically shows how the Federal Reserve has pretty much bought the entire economics profession.
Mm-hmm.
So you talk about this, you talk about the data points and the kind of propaganda machine, and I, you know, look, we just have to call things what they are.
Right.
Like MSNBC and CNBC or the and Acorn are now the Democrats' propaganda machine, and Fox News and the taken over, co-opted Tea Party and whatever are the GOP's propaganda mill.
And it's so interesting that this issue is so relatable to so many things. I mean, you look at, for example, the old Christian church, for example, in England, and how it was the elevation of power, the centralization of power into an elite clergy upon whose good graces all the lower clergy were dependent. And so it really solidified the ability of this propaganda that you're talking about, and the ability to simply give directions and have everyone beneath you follow because they were dependent upon you.
Yes.
I loved in the Audit the Fed debate in July, just a couple months ago, Dennis Kucinich, who you mentioned earlier, he gave this fiery speech. It was awesome. And, you know, I didn't agree with everything in it. He's a Democrat. He has his moments, of course. But there's this line in there that he loved. When he shouted it on the floor of the House. And he said, the Fed acts like a high, exalted priesthood, unaccountable in a democracy. And, of course, I don't, you know, agree that America was set up as a democracy. But the point was taken, and well put, I think, that the Fed acts like a high, exalted priesthood. Exactly as you mentioned, that they've basically bought the economics profession. They've bought out the banks, basically. All the banks have become completely dependent upon the ability to have the Federal Reserve be their economic backstop. And so you see the exact issue, for example, as I said, this is relatable to so many things. You see the same issue with what happened in the Republican National Convention with Mitt Romney, his top lawyer, and John Sununu, his top spokesman, his surrogate, centralizing the power of the Republican Party behind a few individuals. Now, Romney has the ability to handpick his delegates as we head into the next convention, or as Republicans head into the next convention, 4 years. Anytime you have the centralization of authority into a single figure or a limited few, you're going to see this exact same pattern come out. You see it in the Fed. You see it in the Republican Party most recently. You see it in media institutions. And so I think that's what the Internet is so wonderful for, among other things, is that it forces into that centralization a kind of a decentralization catalyst.
Well, this is why they call libertarians individualists, typically. You know, sometimes there's some weird offshoots, but most libertarianism, political philosophy, is individual liberty. And that's because what is the most decentralized form of society or culture? It's the individual. It's the most decentralized you can get.
Right.
It's the atom. And you raise a great point about Kucinich because, you know, you talk about high priests. Well, guess what? And this is something one of my favorite guys in the whole world, greatest thinker in my estimation, at least living libertarian, and that's Thomas Sowers. Thomas Sowers says that the two, you know, that our world is becoming more and more secular. There's less and less of the religious, but we've substituted religion now with two secular religions. One is economics, because it's so much BS, exactly what we're talking about the Fed buying and propagandizing and owning certain media outlets and things of that nature. Not literally, but, you know, more about like embedded journalists, how the Pentagon scooped up all the journalists that way.
Sure.
By having them embedded now. But also, you know, psychiatry, that we either are medicalizing behavior and absconding responsibility for individual behavior with psychiatry, or we're trying to abscond it through entitlements and war and all this other kind of stuff where it's okay for people to take our money. Which it's not.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
The government, I mean.
Well,
you know,
I
without
think,
us willfully doing so.
And I think that's such a fair point. It all boils down to the centralization. You know, if people want to voluntarily, you know, make, allegations or conclusions, psychiatric or economic or whatever, that's fine. And let the marketplace decide if that person is true or not.
Yep.
But by having something like the Federal Reserve in this case that we're talking about and giving them such authority, illegitimate authority, to wield over everyone, of course they're going to buy up the opposition. They're going to, you know, promote and favor those who endorse their views and promote what they're talking about. You know, most recently we see the Fed trying to move towards this open-ended bond purchasing, right? Because
yep.
Bernanke wants to have the ability to more quickly respond to the economy rather than waiting for his quarterly meetings. And there was this chief U.S. economist at Barclays. Of course, what good is a title like chief economist when all these clowns didn't, you know, see the problems that we had?
Right, most of them were complicit.
And they still don't see the problems ahead of us. But I laughed at his quote that he said, you know, moving towards this model would emphasize the unlimited nature of the Fed's balance sheet and that they're willing to do as much as necessary. These economists have become little more than cheerleaders for the Federal Reserve.
Yep.
And so it goes back to the bias. These are just humans.
I'd call them shills, because at least cheerleaders tend to be cute.
Yeah, no. very fair point. I'll gladly use that word. They've become shills for the Fed. And so when you see Congress giving such deference to a Ben Bernanke or these economists and claiming them as like these crystal ball, you know, prophets being able to kind of foresee what's going on and with their infinite wisdom, it's a fraud. And the more that people wake up and realize that these are just human beings with their own biases, that they favor power, that they're going to do whatever it takes to protect their own paycheck, then you recognize they have some inherent conflicts of interest. And maybe what they're saying is not in fact true. And again, I go back to and I, you know, continue to stress the internet. Without the internet and tools like it, we would not be anywhere near where we are. It is because it allows people to realize that the emperor does not have clothes, to collaborate with other people who recognize the same, and to be able to point out whether we're talking about bias in the New York Times because you're reading alternative or foreign media, or the Federal Reserve because you're listening to someone like a Tom Woods. You know, these tools are going to allow us as libertarians, as individuals, to really fight back against the centralization of power, of thought. Without it, I think we'd be dead in the water and we'd be far worse than we are. But even still, we see these things like the Republican National Committee doing its power grab, these you know, efforts to centralize. That's, I think, what we need to fight back about, fight back on, even in private institutions. Because
Guys like you, and by you I mean software programmers, are really going to be key in the future, because I think the key to this is going to be like encryption, to making sure that guys like Jay Rockefeller, and I'm sorry for all you conspiracy nuts, but yes, he is a senator and he wants to have an internet kill switch. I mean, this is just, it's not controversial. And you're right, the internet is our biggest asset right now. And I think guys, programmers that are involved in encryption and even open source stuff are really going to be the heroes of the information age, or whatever you want to call it.
Yeah. Well, job security then, right?
Yeah, I mean, well, not only that, not only job security, but actually really adding to this battle, because you're right. The internet, it's not a push propaganda machine like radio even, or, well, talk radio, we're kind of back and forth, but like TV, say, or print media, it's this pull media where people, if they want to look something up, if you want to go and type in Bernanke is a jerk, you can get all kinds of stuff to support you.
Yeah. And I think that's why we see the independent, the libertarian, the Ron Paul crowd so popular among the youth, who are much more conversant with these
yes.
technologies. You look at the older generation, and they're stuck watching 60 Minutes, by and large, and
right.
they're set in this old mind frame, and they are susceptible to this bias that we're talking about. They have their trusted sources in the news, and
yeah, reruns of they're watching like reruns of Matlock and. Angela Lansbury.
Murder, She Wrote.
Yeah, Murder, She Wrote, exactly.
You know, and so they don't think to even go and check actual sources, look at contrasting information. And so that's why, I mean, I continue to pound the message. I am so hopeful about the future. I think it's going to be rough and tumble. I listened yesterday to that Jim Rogers clip you played before I came on. I think he's right. We're going to go through a tough time. I think the next couple of years are going to be especially bad as we kind of get past the elections, and then some natural consequences are finally unleashed from all the artificial blockage that's been placed, you know, to get us past the election. I think it's going to be a difficult couple of years, but I'm so hopeful about the future, because I look at like my siblings and people who are far younger than I even, and I'm a young guy, reading, you know, The Creature from Jekyll Island,
right?
And, you know, reading these, like, you know, Human Action, these tomes of literature, to really understand the nature of individual liberty. So I think we have our best days yet ahead of us.
Dude, awesome. I appreciate it, man. I think you're right too. I'm an apocalypse optimist. All right, Connor, talk to you next Tuesday, guys. We will be back tomorrow.